Good evening, one and all. Yes, middle of another week, Wednesday, and here this is me, Barry, with another book and a chat here on New Visions Radio. And indeed, what a guest I've got today. What can I say about him? He has been called a juggling genius. Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky. I was raised in the 50s and 60s when entertainment was part of television, not just people who could sing or pretend they can sing. But, you know, we used to watch Sunday night at the London Palladium, for instance, or some of the cabaret shows where we used to have just the star. But we used to have other acts, be it magicians, be it jugglers, be it monocyclists. And then, of course, I was at the end and later on took part in the old time musical stuff. And, of course, the good old days was on BBC for couple of decades, going reliving that period of time. So my guest today brings back a lot of memories, but he's not just a juggler. Oh no, bit more about him. He was a child actor, a toy inventor, teacher in San Quentin prison, a licensed driver and instructor, and now author of two or three books. I think it's three, one coming up. Anyway, better introduce him, haven't I? Because on the show today, I have my pleasure to introduce the one and only Dan Holtzman. Hi, Dan. How are you doing?
Hello, Barry. And it's a pleasure to be on your show. So thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you. And really been looking forward to this because we missed each other before, didn't we? And but this is
I gave you the wrong phone number.
It's easily done. Believe me, it's easily done. I do it all the time, especially with parcels. You know, you have the tracking codes. I'm always sort of getting the numbers round right. I think my right hand types quicker than my left. Sorry, my right finger types quicker than my left. You know, something like that. And you get the letters round the wrong way. Before we get on to the juggling part and the books and everything, your first book was actually about your experiences as Bob Newhart put it, the people who risk their lives every day, driving instructor.
That's actually my second book. My first book was geared towards performers.
Okay.
Because, I spent 36 years as a professional entertainer, and I had collected a lot of tips from my friends about show business, about especially juggling and magic. So my first book was a book of collected tips. And I thought that was a good place to start because it's just sort of, you can format it and it's just trying to get these tips to sound good, but there's no story. It's just a collection.
Right.
And then the second book, I wanted to kind of dwell on something that was true stories. So I didn't want to go into fiction yet. So I had a book about my experiences in show business, but also combined with my experiences as a driving teacher. I was a driving teacher for a year with a company called the Local Driving School. And between my stories about show business and my stories about driving, it's a pretty interesting little book. It's called Driven to Succeed. It's also trying to put across tips about good driving, but also about how being successful in your life, because I think I've done a lot of things that when people look at, like I've been on the Tonight Show four times and done six TED conferences and, worked with celebrities and things, that I'd like to try to impart some of the lessons I learned and how I achieved those, especially to teenagers who also to learn how to be good drivers.
Mm.
And then I went from there to a book, my first novel, which is called Alex the Great.
Right.
And that I based on my experiences working at Pier 39, but it's a fictional story set in a world I know very well. So I thought that was a very good progression. And the book I just finished is called Bloodsuckers. And it's about it's sort of a stoner vampire book.
Oh, okay.
So I just went totally like, okay, now I want to do something completely fictional.
Right.
Where I'm just making up the entire world. And the basis for that one is there's some young college students and they want to grow some marijuana. And they find out that they've grown it on the grave of a vampire.
Oh, crikey.
So when this marijuana comes up, he gives the people who smoke it the munchies for blood.
Oh, that is such
a fun concept.
Very fun concept. I'm listening to it thinking, my goodness, what a great concept that is.
Yeah, it was such a fun concept. I thought, I can run with that, And I've been known to partake in the herb a bit, I must admit. So, I've never been a vampire.
No.
But not enough books for stoners, I don't think. So this has a bit of that vibe.
There you go. It's great. When did you first get into juggling?
I learned in 1974. I was 14. And I started to see it on TV a little bit. So I became aware of, oh, there's this thing called juggling, really. And there was a book. I love books. I've always loved books and bookstores. And right when I became aware of juggling, there was a book that came out called The Juggling Book by Carlo. So it was a perfect kind of sort of meeting of seeing it in the bookstore and seeing it on TV. And immediately I was hooked because I could go in my backyard and just entertain myself. I was a bit of a loner. So I learned when I was 14. And by the time I was 17, I was good enough to start getting some work. And then I put an act together with a friend of mine. And by the time we were like 20, we were actually getting like really good work, like cruise ships and review shows. And then when I was 24, we had an opportunity to be on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And that was a career-changing moment because from there, we started opening for celebrities because we became aware of this opening act market. And the first celebrity we opened with was Billy Crystal, the comedian, in Atlantic City. And our fee and everything just, you know, shot up to $10,000 a week from a couple of guys working at a Renaissance fair the week before, you know.
Yeah.
Making $1,500 or something. You do the Tonight Show, people become aware of you, and these opportunities came in. And from there, he had the same management as Robin Williams. So we then started to tour with Robin Williams, and we did that for about 7 years.
Wow.
Sporadically, because he did a lot of movies.
Yeah,
and occasionally he would go out and do some colleges. So when I said I toured with him for 7 years, that sounds a lot more elaborate than it was.
Right.
You know, because it was so sporadic.
Right.
But I did get to watch a lot of his shows and spend some time with him, and that was a great pleasure to meet him and all these other comedians
I
got to work with. Really enjoyable.
And you even performed for a president, didn't you?
Yes, Ronald Reagan. There's a show called The Festival at Ford's, and they have a lot of big celebrities, but they always mix it up with some novelty acts. Our year, I think they had a tap dance duo, a magician, and us. And the big stars were, like, at the time, LaToya Jackson.
Yep.
Not Janet or Michael, but LaToya.
Yep.
And then there were guys like the Golden Boys of Bandstand, which were like a Frankie Avalon and Bobby Rydell. And Rosemary Clooney.
Yeah.
I think they kind of sort of geared more towards his taste.
Right.
And when we met him, we got to meet him in a line. Like, you're led up to him in a line.
Yeah.
And my partner said, we're going to be juggling on the show. And he turned to Nancy Reagan, and he said, Mommy, they're going to have jugglers. You know, excited. So it was kind of fun to hear that. So he loved our act. It was really a... The whole show, I didn't look at him. It's only like an 8-minute routine.
Right.
But I thought it would freak me out to look down and see the president.
Oh, crikey. But it's not just the president. You also ended up entertaining a jury.
Oh, yeah. We did the O.J. Simpson jury. I was fascinated by the O.J. Simpson case because I lived in L.A. during that time.
Okay.
And I had heard that you could go to entertain the jury, that they were sequestered at hotels. And on the weekends, they would be brought into the courtroom, and people would be brought in to entertain them. So we sent a letter to Judge Ito. His name was Lance Ito.
Yep.
And sure enough, they said, sure, come on in. No vetting, no advice, no like...
Seriously?
Don't say that.
Wow.
Nothing. We could have been the most famous jugglers in the world if we had gone in and like caused a mistrial.
Right.
Like, you know he's guilty, right? You know he's guilty.
Well, that's.
And we brought in knives. We brought in like machetes.
Yeah.
We brought in,
and nobody said anything.
Juggling things.
Nobody said anything. Oh, that's amazing. That really.
No, but we, of course, we didn't. You know, we were polite. We didn't, because I thought he was guilty all the way.
Oh, cracky! The rest of the world did, believe me. But yeah.
Well, when he was doing that white Bronco chase, in that moment, no one was more guilty.
Yeah.
But once the lawyers got a hold of him and said, "Look, you know, no one saw you do it, right?" All of a sudden, a whole new story emerged.
Yeah.
But nobody behaves like that after the murder of their wife.
No, I remember in England we were watching this one car going down the middle of the road with about 50 police cars behind, you know, and keep going. But he's innocent. Yeah, like heck.
And he's got money and a passport in the disguise.
Yeah.
But he didn't do it.
No. The glove, wasn't it? The glove with the... he had blood and all that.
The glove, and it was very much in response to the Rodney King riot.
Right, right.
And when I saw the jury, I mean, the jury was primarily African American.
Uh-huh.
And I think that my belief was that they felt that the case was so strong that they needed a primarily African American jury to convict him, or there'd be riots like you would not believe.
Right.
But I think in response to the systematic racism of the police, which is obviously a big problem,
mm-hmm.
that community, and I don't blame them, had no faith in the police.
Right, right.
And then when the one fellow, Furman, comes out as being very racist because he uses all this racist language.
Right.
It doesn't matter how strong the case is. They lost it in that kind of political environment.
Indeed so.
But it's very interesting to be there and see it in
person. Oh,
I bet it was.
My first introduction to American justice was not far off that farcical, I tell you. Anyway, never mind about me. You're not just any juggler, as I said. You know, numerous awards and stuff. And in fact, you've even got 2 entries in the Guinness Book of Records.
Yeah, I mean, there's only so many things available to you as a juggler, and one of them is to try to break records, you know, as far as to get exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very interested in trying to get into the book, and you realize it's easier to get in with a new record than to beat an existing record.
Yeah.
So I set 2 records that have subsequently been beaten many times. So I always say I'm a Guinness Records setter, because I'm no longer a Guinness Records holder.
There you go. That's the way to do it, isn't it? Somebody's got to set these records.
Yeah, like I have one for bouncing a golf ball on the face of a golf club. Like I was the first person to have that record.
Right.
I'm sure people did it before me, but I was the first person to go in and say, look, I'd like to set a record doing this stunt.
There you go.
Because they had no listing for it.
Right.
And I did it. I think I did it on the first try. I did like 1,500 bounces.
Wow.
And they're like, well, that's enough. I'm like, all right. And now it's like 40,000 or something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous when you do, you know, get on that.
I have no interest in trying to reclaim it.
You were the first. It's like climbing Everest. You were the first. There you go.
Well, I was a Guinness record holder. I did get in the book. I was listed in the book twice. And I had a picture in the other book for the other stunt, which was 8 shaker cups, which is a type of juggling where the cups nest together.
Yep.
They fit together. You throw them all up at once, and then you catch them one, bum, 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 bum. You know, they stack together as you catch them.
Okay, yeah.
So they separate, and then you catch them as they come back together.
Wow.
And so I did 8.
Wow,
another
that's a lot.
Like
yeah.
14 or 12. So.
Really?
God, once again, another record I have no interest in trying to recapture. I probably couldn't, no matter how much I worked at it.
Right.
So a setter, but not a holder.
There you go. The book, the first novel, shall we say, mm-hmm. Alex the Great, using your own experience, obviously, they say write about what you know, as I do myself. This was sort of you learning at, was it, PF 39?
It's the story of a teenager. So I went there myself. I was already in my, this was after my partner and I broke up, basically.
Oh, okay.
In my 40s or 50s. I'm probably more like the older character. It's more the story of a young teenager who goes to Pier 39, which is our local sort of tourist area here in San Francisco, where they have entertainers. They have mm-hmm. like street jugglers and escape artists. And he goes and sees a juggler, and that experience changes his life. He meets this mentor, and it turns out, I don't want to give away too much.
Of course not.
It turns out he comes from a very wealthy family. And the juggler thinks he's a street kid. So that causes sort of a dilemma, because some of the other performers kind of feel as if he joins the program and starts to perform, he's taking money out of their pockets that he doesn't need.
Right.
So they think it's, you know, that he's not right for it because he's rich. And then his rich parents think he's not right for it because it's beneath him.
Yeah.
So he's getting it from both sides, where his parents don't approve and the people in it don't approve, because they find out about his background, but his love for it shines through, and he overcomes these obstacles. And it's a very coming-of-age story about a kid finding his own identity and his own path, and he finds he loves juggling. And it's, why not? Why is that less valid of a path for somebody than choosing, you know, the law or
becoming
a doctor.
Exactly. So, it's a calling or a job, whatever you want to call it, you know, then that's it.
But some people think, you know, juggling is silly. Like, if I tell people I'm a professional juggler, they're like, oh, will you come to my kid's birthday party for $75? Or your poor mother, you know, as if she must be very shocked and disappointed that she became a juggler. But like you said, through my experiences, I got to meet the president.
Yeah.
I got to see the world. I got to go to China and Dubai and Qatar and have all these experiences by being a juggler. So for me, it was a personal story in that this, first of all, the career of juggling had value.
Mm-hmm.
And that the idea of a child being pushed into something they don't want to do, whether they'd make more money or there'd be more social acceptance for their parents, like they could sort of brag, like my kid's a lawyer, it really is important for people to find their own way and their own path. That's sort of the theme of the book.
Indeed. And obviously you're able to use some of your own experiences with the hints and tips that you learned to have it your hero learn, sort of thing.
Well, there was a book, The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, which I really enjoyed, where he used a fictional story to incorporate lessons that he's learned about life that you're trying to pass on. So I've also tried to pass on experience I've had about life and how the art of street performing can relate to your life.
Because
there's lots of parallels between the feedback you get from an audience who are reacting to your material and the feedback you get from life. Like, are you being successful? Or is life telling you you're doing something wrong? And you're not listening to that feedback.
I always
say it's a very multi-leveled book, I hope.
Yeah. I always say that, you know, we have a lot of people perhaps have written about illness or abuse or something like that. If they put their experiences into a fictional story, people rather than sort of 10 things to do and not to do and stuff like that, people will read that as a story. They will put themselves in the place of the hero or the main character, something they can relate to. So as they're reading it, they are subconsciously, you know, looking at themselves, whether it be to make their life better, whether it to be, you know, went through an abusive relationship, what have you. And thus they sort of, people enjoy that sort of thing and educate themselves more from that sort of thing in that format, I believe.
I like to read about different worlds. Like, I don't have to be that interested in professional wrestling to read about a wrestler.
Right.
So to me, it's set in a very interesting world of street performers. And a lot of the characters are based on the real characters I worked with. There's a couple who have been changed their names to protect the guilty, let's say.
Right.
But a lot of my friends really recognize themselves in these characters. I really drew upon real experiences. Because it's such a fun environment. You're doing shows, and you have this group of performers who are kind of a gypsy renegade group, because a lot of them get into street performing because they don't want to deal with contracts.
Right.
They don't want to deal with the mainstream entertainment. We can just go out, and if you're good, people give you money.
Yeah.
It's sort of a very straightforward exchange. You do the show, and they can walk away, or they can stay and give you money. So a lot of the book is, What causes someone to stay and give you money? What's that secret that you need to get people willing to give you money? Which, of course, is a great skill in everyday life.
Right.
The ability to have people give you money, you know, for doing something. So
I really
enjoyed writing it. I'd love to do a sequel someday. So hopefully people will check out Alex the Great. And I know what you say about illnesses and sort of a deeper book. But I like my books to be really page turners.
Yeah.
And just fun. You could read it in a sitting or two, get lost in it. I try to keep it really cinematic and moving. So a lot of the scenes I try to create very vivid, sort of picturesque scenes without that much description or that much interior dialogue.
Yeah.
So sort of more of a movie experience for the reader. I want them to get lost in it.
Exactly.
Like you said before, use their imagination to be part of the. They can picture themselves in that story and sharing those experiences.
To my mind, I mean, when I wrote my YA books, it was I wrote it like in lots of little short stories. I mean, the chapters are pretty short, and I was looking at the old Saturday morning cinema, the serial, you know, come next week, see what happens with the hero dangling from the railway track or whatever, you know. And you get something like that, and people just read and read They can't stop. They sit there and they basically read through it because they want to know what happens next. And it sounds very similar to, that you've done with your book.
Yes, Barry, it sounds very similar. I like short chapters and cliffhangers.
Yeah.
Like, what happens next? I want to end a chapter where they have to turn to the next chapter.
Exactly.
I like parallel storytelling, too, where, you have stories that converge. Like the story I have, this new recent one, Bloodsuckers, It starts with a vampire in the 1880s, and he's killed in a very bloody, horrible fashion, and his body is, beheaded and placed in this field, and his blood saturates the earth. And then it switches to, modern-day time. You're like, well, what's that got to do with these two stoner kids?
Right.
And then when a plot line kind of converges and comes together, I like that kind of thing where you're sort of seeing it, and then it's sort of the two perspectives come together.
Yeah.
And you sort of understand it from more than one angle.
It's funny because we were talking, I told you earlier, Steve Berry and I were sort of talking last night, and he comes on every year with his latest book. And he's a historian, basically. He loves history, and he finds a weird historical fact sort of thing. And then what he does is bring that fact, how that historical fact can affect something today. So he's got the I never knew that historical thing, and then the, wow, this could affect, in this case, the sort of next president of Germany sort of thing. But it's great when you've got that, because you learn and you're entertained as well. And it makes you think, wow, what if, sort of thing.
Well, if a book doesn't make you learn something, or you don't get something other from it than just sort of a... I mean, I like sort of stuff that's very fluffy and light. From Sidney Sheldon to, the Stephen Kings and the page turners, the John Grishams, and I just love it. I love to get lost in a book.
Right.
I love the feeling of...
Oh, cracky,
I like
yes.
things to bring me out of it. I don't like, what's that mean? Or that doesn't make sense. Or why would... The character wouldn't say that.
Nah.
Like to be realistic in within that context of, like I say, like this book about vampires. There's lots of things that aren't based in realism.
Yeah.
But they have to make sense, right? They have to be logic behind your choices.
Yeah, to make people think.
I want to be in this for the long haul, author thing.
There you go. What's this toy that you invented?
Well, one of my philosophies is this idea of sort of a directed thought. Like you want to accomplish something. Like you want to get in the Guinness Book, or you want to get on TV, or you want to be able to sell books. That's what I want to try to do now.
Mm-hmm.
Is not just write books, but try to sell books,
yep.
which is, as you probably know, probably harder, or much harder than the writing of the book.
Oh, cracky, yeah. I say to people who come on the show with their debut book, I say, you've got the book in your hand, that's when the hard work starts.
Well, the work should really start before the book's in your hand. I mean, it really seems like you have to sort of lay the groundwork with this, the book funnels and the launching pages.
Oh, yeah.
The stuff I really don't want to do, but it seems like
it's
to be
got
successful.
Got to these days, yeah.
Got to. So the toy idea was I wanted to invent a toy. And I had come up with one before that was a failure because it was too big, like it didn't fit in your pocket.
Right.
And if you saw it, you didn't know what it did unless someone explained it to you. So I came up with this idea, the ball on stick toy where you sort of swing a ball up and catch it in the little cup.
Yeah.
And you hold the stick between your fingers. I thought, what if instead of you holding this little stick in your fingers, it was a ring? And you try to flip the ball up and catch it in the ring.
Ah.
So you wore it on your finger. And it was sort of, so I called it the Ring Dama.
Okay.
The other one's called the Ken Dama. Because in Japanese, Dama's ball and Ken is stick.
Oh, yeah.
So I called mine the Ring Dama. And I went to a toy show in New York City, which is the big, another thing I wanted to do was go to this toy show. Because it's famous here, in New York.
Yep.
Happens once a year. So I got involved with a company called Kendama USA. They helped me make this toy. But I wanted to sell the toy because, once again, it's hard to, as an individual person to sell one toy.
Hmm.
I wanted the company to buy it and make an electronic version that lit up.
Right.
So at this company, I found a company called Zing, who made a toy called the Thumbchuck that had a ball that lit up that was a perfect size. And they were doing a line of toys that was a pocket-sized, skill-based line of toys. So it fit perfectly into their line of toys. they called it the Zing Dama. Right? So mine was the Ring Dama. I sold them the rights.
Right.
And they called it the Zing Dama. So I got a percentage. I got a commission. And they made a deal with Walmart where they sold over $1 million worth of this toy to Walmart. So I got a check for $54,000.
Oh, nice. Very nice.
Every check since then was I think the next one was 12. And
right.
Four.
It's gone down since then, right? Yeah.
And after a year, it was like, you know, do you want this check for, you know, $200?
Right.
Because most toys only have a 1 year cycle.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, I'm a toy inventor now.
There
not
you go.
Not realizing how much timing and opportunity, and sort of I got lucky. I was at the tail end of the fidget spinner craze.
Right.
So I was just at the right place at the right time.
That's
with the
great.
Right product.
Well,
I did the work, but I benefited from luck as well.
We have been lucky enough and timed it just right to have you on the show today, Dan. So what I'm going to do now, though, is hand the show over to you so that you can tell everybody where they can find out more about you and your books and, of course, hopefully in time, your new book.
Well, right now we're in the process of putting our book electronically, but right now it's not available electronically yet. It's available on Amazon.com. This is probably the best place to find it. The title is Alex the Great, and it takes place in San Francisco. It's the story of a young teenager finding his path in life. If you want to find out about me as a juggler, my website is danholzman.com. It's DanHolzman. And you can find out about my life as a juggler. Or if you look up Raspini Brothers on YouTube,
okay.
That was the name of my team, my juggling team.
Okay.
And my new book's going to be Budsuckers, probably out within a couple of months.
Okay, well, Dan, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I was really looking forward to it. I had a feeling it was going to be a good one. It certainly has been. Good luck with the book, and good luck with the new book when it comes out.
Thank you so much, Barry. I really appreciate this opportunity.
My pleasure. Thank you. Well, there you go. My guest today, Dan Holzman, H-O-L-Z, as he said, or Z as I say, M-A-N, H-O-L-Z-M-A-N. And you can find him, you say, danholzman.com, and it's got all about his, you know, him and his records and some pictures and some YouTube snips and stuff like that there. Great stuff, really enjoyable, and I'm sure that book, and definitely the next one, The Budsuckers, sounds just equally enjoyable. Well, that's it for this week. I will be back on Saturday. On Sunday, of course, 5 to 6pm Eastern with Those Were the Days, music from the 20th century. And we have a theme this week. We're starting on One Hit Wonders for the next 3 or 4 weeks. So see if you can scratch that brain and try and think of some One Hit Wonders from the 20th century. And then after that, from 6 to 7pm, we have the Swinging 60s, music from not just the British Invasion, but from around the world from the 60s. And then next Tuesday, of course, I'll be back with a fresh guest here on A Book and a Chat. Well, that's it for now. As always, I've got one thing left to say. Don't forget. Make sure it's working. That was